68 degrees Kenosha, 65 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In honor of the Olympic Games currently underway in Paris, France, we're going to be playing for you four different interviews out of the morning show archives, each related in one way or another to this greatest of all athletic spectacles. A little later, we're going to be hearing from a filmmaker about a marvelous documentary called The Boys of 36, which tells the inspiring story of an American rowing team that won Olympic gold against all odds. We'll also be hearing from Sports Illustrated writer Jeremy Fuchs talking about his wonderful and entertaining book called Total Olympics. But we're going to begin with two interviews with Olympic athletes, and the first with diver Jordan Windle. He competed for the United States in the 2020 Olympics, which, because of COVID, were actually not held until 2021. And I was able to record a Zoom interview with both Jordan Windle and his father, Jerry Windle, talking about the experience of diving at this very elite level. Jordan Windle was actually a participant in three Olympic trials, and it was in his third and final trials that he was finally able to secure a place on America's Olympic team.
The first time I went to the Olympic trials, I was actually 13 years old, and you're supposed to be 14, but I was turning 14 the year of the Olympics, so I was allowed to compete at 13 years old. And you know, obviously at that age, I didn't have the experience or the dives capable of actually, placing high enough to go to the Olympics, but, it was mainly, you know, I was mainly there to compete for the experience and, to get kind of used to the atmosphere in itself and competing with such a high level. And then I went, you know, four more years later again, I got a little bit closer. I ended up placing fourth, behind David Dinsmore, Steele Johnson, and David Bodaya. And that was an extraordinary event. And, you know, I'm very thankful to be able to have the opportunity to dive against all those guys. And then, you know, following that 5 years later, you know, because of COVID pushing back the Olympics and the trials as well, we ended up going to the Olympic trials in Indianapolis, Indiana. And, you know, I had high hopes, but I wanted to stay realistic going into it, being smart about my body and the events that I had to compete in. I was actually qualified in the men's individual 3 meter as well as the 10 meter. So I was doing two events there. And, you know, going into the 10 meter, I did pretty well in prelims. I placed second following Brandon Lasciavo. And then going into semis, I remained in second with, I think, around a 70-point cushion from my place to the third place qualifier. And the, you know, from that, you know, I had a lot of momentum going into the competition, and I was very positive with how the meet was going. But, you know, the next day I had to then prepare myself for men's 3 meter individual, which not many people would recommend doing two events at an Olympic trials trying to qualify. And I could understand why, because when I actually started the event, I started to have a little bit of strain within my upper body and my triceps. And I took it upon myself to talk to my coach, Matt Scoggin. And I told him that, you know, I think it's smart to, you know, pull out of the 3 meter event and focus solely on the 10 meter, what's important. And we did so and ended up qualifying. So it was quite the journey.
Wow. I remember you saying that when you were interviewed afterwards. So Jerry, what has it been like for you to be the proud father in the stands for all kinds of meets over the years, but in particular, three Olympic trials and with so much riding on this last one in particular? How do you keep from just exploding from the enthusiasm?
You know, it really is hard. And it's every dive that Jordan performed at the Olympic trials, I was reliving every moment of the 15 years of him practicing 4 to 5 hours a day, 6 days, even as an elementary school student. And then I was taken back to the 2012 Olympic trials, and Greg Louganis was there, and Kent, Mary Ellen Clark, all Olympic medalists. And they pulled Jordan aside, and we actually have a picture of the three of them with Jordan. And they told Jordan when he was 13 years old, you are going to be an Olympian. You're going to be one of us. And it's just not your time yet. And they were there at this Olympic trials to celebrate with him. And it was, you know, it was a culmination of all the hard work and the sacrifices that Jordan has made throughout the years that made me so proud. You know, he gave up going to a normal brick and mortar public school. He's been on Team USA since he was 13 years old. So since the age of 12 or 13, he's been in a virtual learning academy. He didn't have homecoming. He didn't have football games. He didn't have a prom because he dedicated his life to this sport. You know, his degree is in the culture of sport at University of Texas, and he's wanting to be a coach. So diving is his life. And what made it even more special for me is this was Jordan's journey. You know, some parents are kind of the sideline parents that live vicariously through their kids. I was never one of those. I wanted to enjoy the ride. I wanted to be able to give Jordan the opportunity to be the best version of himself that he could be. And he took that opportunity. I supported him all along the way. And for to see that pay off, I think is a testament to not only his tenacity and his stick-to-itiveness, but also to this idea that any parent who gives their child or a community that gives a child an opportunity, you don't know the magic that can happen if that child has the fortitude and resilience and tenacity to make it happen. And that's what I saw in Jordan. And I think that's what so many people saw in him. And that is what makes me so proud. I love that he's going to the Olympics. I love that he will forever be an Olympian. But more than that, I'm so proud of the human being that he is and the citizen, not only a United States citizen, but a global citizen. And to me, that's what really makes me so proud of the young man he's become.
Hmm. Jordan, your performance in these Olympic trials was highlighted by an amazing dive in the very first round in which you scored 5 out of 7 perfect tens. First of all, in your competition history at this level, I mean, in terms of this level of competition, had you ever done that before? Or was that, in a sense, the summit of what you've thus far achieved as a diver?
I have scored perfect tens before. I don't want to come off cocky, and I'm sorry if it does. It's not meant to, but you know, during my collegiate career, being able to perform, you know, next to people that are Olympians and have similar goals like me to reach the Olympics, to win an NCAA championship, you know, you want to perform at the highest level possible and also show that, you know, you can stand next to these guys, and, you know, and these guys are my family. So I want to make everyone proud, including my dad, my family, and my teammates. And that's just how I've always been throughout my whole diving career. And, you know, when I'm having fun and I'm feeling good during a competition, healthy and a good mindset, a lot of positive things can come out from that. So
yeah. I remember one of the commentators during this telecast. It was towards the very end when the results were very clear, and that you and Brandon Lo Schiavo were going to be the two representatives for the United States in the 10 meter platform. And there are all kinds of hugs and lots of tears at poolside. And one of the commentators said, this is a family. And of course, not just you and specifically your college teammates, but all of you from competing schools, all of you who maybe don't even otherwise know each other all that well. Jordan, can you just expound a little on that sense of family, of community amongst divers who are also fierce competitors with one another?
Can you help us
understand what that's like?
Yeah, of course. And I think, you know, coming into the sport and why I love this sport so much, in my opinion, when you're not relating it to the Olympics, if we're just talking about diving just in general, it's somewhat of a small sport, but we're a very tightly netted group, and you know, everyone knows each other and we all support each other, even in competition. And when, you know, you could consider one another rivals, we still want each other to do well. And I think what makes me love this sport so much and love everyone that I'm able to compete against is we want to beat each other at our best. You know, we want everyone to be healthy. We want everyone to be at 100% competing at the best, so that, you know, no matter what, whoever's the best on that day, they take the top. And, you know, in the video that you saw with the commentary and with all the tears, I mean, there was just so much love in the air and the atmosphere. There was so much positivity. I mean, obviously, you know, two people are only allowed to compete for the US, but, you know, it's such a family-based atmosphere that no matter who goes, you know, we all look out for each other and we're all very grateful for the outcome.
One of the highlights for me was Jordan and Dave have been competing since they were 8 years old. They've known each other at almost every meet since 8 years old. And you know, being genuine friends, as much of a letdown it was for David, he was just as extremely happy for Jordan. And that's that sense of family and community, that even though it wasn't your day that day, not to be angry with the person that stepped up because everybody was diving at their best, but to celebrate their friend who has achieved a goal. And that to me is just, it's something that you can't put a price tag on. It's a beautiful thing.
Right. You're referring to third place finisher David Dinsmore. And I'm mm-hmm. so glad that you acknowledge that. And it means a lot coming from you. I mean, the father of Jordan, who is going to the Olympics, to acknowledge the grace of David Dinsmore in what was, of course, a moment of, for him, disappointment, but very happy for Jordan. And Jordan, I wanted you to say a word about the young man who came in fourth, who was 14 years old, Joshua Hedberg. And of course, you've been in the trials as a 13-year-old, so you know something about what it's like to be a little kid head-to-head with all of these strapping young adults and holding your own. I just wonder if you have any brief impressions you want to share about this young 14-year-old and what might be ahead for him.
Yeah, I mean, Josh is an extraordinary diver, and at such a young age, he's excelling way faster than, you know, even myself. And I can say that with full confidence, he is better at his age than I was at his age. And it's amazing because he holds himself so well. He's very confident, very clear-minded when he's competing. And, you know, when he's diving, it's almost as if he's a 20-year-old, like he's diving at the highest level, even though he's a young teenager. And he's very well spoken. And, you know, for the future to come, I mean, it's going to be endless for him. And I'm not looking forward to competing against him when he reaches his peak.
Understood. One last question about the community of divers, and then I want to delve into the father-son story. Jerry, as someone in the stands, we mostly got to see you as you were cheering ferociously for your son, for whom you are so incredibly proud and love so much. I'm just curious, are you one of those fathers who sits in the stands stoically while other divers are diving? And do you save your applause for Jordan? I suspect the answer is no. You seem like somebody who is there to celebrate the sport and all of these fine competitors, even those that are not your son.
Yeah, you know, you see in some sports where, you know, parents in the stands will maybe silently or not so silently you know, wish mistakes on other athletes. And when you have these types of competitions, either gymnastics or ice skating or diving, these divers do things that 99.9% of the rest of us can't even dream of doing. And so the athleticism that is required and the commitment and the dedication to compete at this level, in my opinion, deserves absolute respect. You know, I think that I don't like when parents get too overly aggressively involved in their athlete's performance outside of being a spectator, because that's what I am at that time. I'm a spectator. You know, I want Jordan to be, and I've told him this, and he can confirm it, have fun, smile, be humble, and stay healthy. And so long, I don't care where he ends up. I truly don't. As long as he has had fun and he's enjoyed the ride, because when he has children and grandchildren, I want him to be able to look back and say, remember when, and to have those really good memories. And so, you know, I was cheering for David and for Tyler and for every other competitor that was out there, because I wanted them to have fun. I wanted them to stay safe. And as Jordan said, you want everybody to compete at their best, because if you win because someone else failed, that's not as sweet a victory, you know? And when you can win on that particular day, when everybody is at their best, how amazing is that? And these kids put in, you know, thousands and thousands of hours. And I think they deserve the cheer and applause of everybody in the stand, regardless of who they may or may not be, you know, hoping is able to make the team.
That was Jerry Windle. His talented son, Jordan, ended up placing ninth in the 10-meter platform diving event at the 2020 Olympics, actually held in the summer of 2021 because of COVID. And sadly, due to COVID protocols, there were no fans permitted in the stands. So Jordan's father, Jerry, had to watch the event along with the rest of us on television. Next up is an interview that I was privileged to record back in 2008 with decorated American gymnasts Paul and Morgan Hamm, identical twin brothers from Waukesha, Wisconsin. Paul was the all-around champion at the 2004 Olympics, and he also was the all-around champion at the 2003 World Championships, and Paul and Morgan were both members of the U.S. silver medal-winning team at the 2004 Olympics. This interview was recorded shortly before the 2008 Olympic trials, at a time when both Paul and Morgan were hoping to once again represent the United States in the upcoming 2008 Olympics. Could you talk for a moment about growing up outside of Waukesha on a farm and of some of the interesting ways in which you pursued your dream of gymnastics glory while also being Wisconsin farm boys?
Yeah, we actually really enjoyed growing up on the farm. We started gymnastics when we were 7 years old, and we thought it looked like a lot of fun. And what was funny is my dad, in order to allow us to play at home, he built us gymnastics equipment that we put up around the farm. We had a little high bar. We had a trampoline that was in the barn. We had parallel bars that were set up out there, a pommel horse, you name it. So it was a really fun time for us. We grew up on the farm. We, you know, we're from Waukesha and are very proud to be from Wisconsin.
Very good. What is it that initially drew you to gymnastics?
Well, our sister started first, and she's a little bit older than us, about 2 years, and she looked like she was having so much fun that Paul started shortly after that, and then I didn't want to be left out, so I was like, I'm joining as well. Mm. And it was a whole family thing. We really had a lot of fun doing it. We would play in the yard. We would, you know, try to learn new skills and flip around, and it was exciting, and it was really important for us to get that time to play.
At some point, were you able to put aside chores on the farm? I wonder, because it seems like it's fun to grow up on a farm, but it's easy to get hurt. And, of course, for a gymnast, especially promising gymnasts like yourself, you don't want to do anything that would unnecessarily deter your dreams.
Yeah, our dad had us do some work, but we didn't actually like grow up on a farm and raise animals and do that whole type of thing. But we were on the farmland, and we did have to do some things. We, of course, mowed the lawn. Our dad had us out rototilling and doing other stuff. But as we got older and older and more involved in the sport and pushed to a higher level, he started to let us do less and less because he knew that those things could potentially be harmful and that, you know, we didn't want to do anything that would hurt our gymnastics.
At what point did gymnastics start to kind of crowd everything else out and become kind of the real central focus of your lives? I mean, already when you were in high school, I imagine it had already really taken center stage.
Yeah, we progressed quickly in the sport, and from a very young age, it became the only sport that we trained. We tried t-ball and soccer, and we just knew right away when we started gymnastics that that was for us. So we really concentrated all of our energy on that, and I mean, we did have to make sacrifices. I remember missing football games in high school or not being able to go to dances because I was traveling on international competitions. And all that stuff was, you know, it's hard to deal with, but it's worth it because you get that final result of going to the Olympic Games and competing for your country, and you realize that all of that sacrifice has really come to be something that's special.
Tell us a little bit about the two of you as brothers, as, in a sense, teammates and also competitors. And I'm especially curious how that relationship has changed over the years, if it has changed. I mean, if the nature of this double pursuit has changed very much from the days when you were youngsters as opposed to what that relationship is now today.
Well, I'd have to say that it hasn't changed a whole lot since we were younger. We want the best for each other when we're in a competition. I'm always rooting for Morgan, and he's rooting for me to do well. But what's interesting about gymnastics is in a lot of cases you're competing on a team together, and in the same case you're competing as individuals against each other. So there is that competitiveness, and we dealt with it very well from a young age, and we didn't have a very big rivalry between us. And you know, I know that for myself, like, I get more nervous when Morgan's competing than I do for my, you know, when I'm competing myself.
What's it like for your folks to be in the stands watching you compete?
It's nerve-wracking. I know that my mom gets nervous before a competition, and sometimes she's pacing up outside of the arena, you know, just trying to wish the best for us. But it's stressful for them as well. And I think sometimes it's easier for the people out there competing for us than for the parents that have to watch, and they can't control any part of it. We get to control our own destiny. They have to be the spectators. And, you know, they really enjoy watching us, but at the same time it's stressful, and hopefully they'll be there in Beijing to watch us do well if we both make the team.
We're talking with Morgan and Paul Hamm, and the Olympic U.S. gymnastic trials are coming up within the next couple of weeks, I think, right?
Yeah.
In the very near future. I should think that this is a really tough part of your of this life, this fact that you are at that moment when the team is being assembled and you are competing very much against your fellow Americans, some of whom I'm sure are friends. Tell us a little bit about what this particular competition feels like and that specific aspect of it.
The trials process is very stressful for all the guys who are trying to make the team, and only six guys in the country get to go compete for the United States in Beijing, and everybody wants to be on the team. So it's tough. You're competing against your friends. You're competing against possibly siblings, like in my case of Morgan. But it's something you have to deal with, and we've been through it before. I've been in two Olympic trials in the past and trying to get onto our third Olympics. Unfortunately, I will not be able to compete at the Olympic trials. I hurt myself.
So this is Paul we're hearing from
Paul
right now.
Yeah. Competing right now. Yeah. I hurt myself at the U.S. Championships. I broke my hand. So I'm recovering from that, and my goal is to be healthy in about 7 weeks to show a committee that I am prepared and ready to compete for the United States at the Olympic Games.
So is that the point when the team is officially named 7 weeks from now?
Well, what happens in this case is the team will be named at the Olympic trials. I will be named on the team, and if I do not prove that I'm ready to compete at that time when I'm supposed to show a committee, then I will be replaced with someone else.
So an alternate will step in your place then.
Exactly.
Right. I should think, and both of you, of course, Morgan, you've experienced some injuries, I know. In fact, right around the time of the last Olympics, weren't you nursing an injury of some kind? Do I remember that right?
I've had some injuries in the past. I hurt my shoulder in 2001, and that has been hindering me all throughout the last Olympic time period. But last October, I actually tore my chest and had surgery, and have been recovering. And it's been a great recovery. I actually competed at the U.S. Championships and made the Olympic trials. So I'm excited about where I'm headed, and hopefully I make that team. Both Paul and I have faced challenges in the sport, but what we're here doing today is really exciting because our challenges aren't even close to some of the challenges that kids face in other countries around the world where they're dealing with poverty and disease and things like that. And we're here with, we're teaming up with Listerine to help promote a program that's called Right to Play Red Ball Child's Play Program. And it's designed to help kids in about 23 countries around the world get access to equipment so that they can get out there and play and enjoy themselves and learn those life lessons such as teamwork, fair play, and respect.
Tell our listeners what Listerine itself is doing in terms of contributing to the cause.
Well, one of the things you can do to get involved is go to www.listerine.com, and there's a red ball on that page, and if you click on it, Listerine will donate $1 to this cause. So, and that's up into $100,000, and Listerine is, you know, very happy to be teaming up with us for this cause, and we can help so many kids around the world. It's a great thing for kids to have the opportunity to play, learn these life lessons that are so valuable that we take for granted here in the United States.
Very good. Paul particularly, but Morgan also, and both of you, if you've contended with injuries and trying to make the comeback, I suppose one of the most challenging things is to figure out how hard to push yourself versus stepping back, being cautious, being careful. What advice can you to give to anybody who's had to face that same sort of balancing act between pushing yourself yet not too hard?
Well, I guess it depends on what situation you're in. As far as me, this is Paul speaking right now. I'm in the position where it's crunch time. I need to basically push as hard as I can and make sure that I can, you know, stay away from re-injuring my hand or anything like that. But there, it's a risk game, and you have to make sure that you don't push past the limits and injure yourself. And you have to balance those things. And I'd say for the average person in recovering, you know, take it slow, make sure you recover, do all the things your doctor says that you should do, and you'll be back out there healthy and ready to go.
So, Paul, right now, what are you doing, for instance, in your recovery? You had surgery fairly recently, right?
A week ago, yeah.
Right. So right now, are you not doing anything that remotely resembles gymnastics?
Well, there's a lot I can do still. I can train my legs. I can train my stomach, my back. There's a lot of arm exercises I can do that don't require the use of my hand. So I'm doing everything I can to keep my body in top physical form. I just am not able to do a lot of the gymnastic skills where my hand is being placed on the equipment. I'll be able to do that in about 4 weeks, and hopefully by then, you know, maybe I'll be stronger in some ways than I used to be if I really push myself during this time to improve.
Hmm. And Morgan, your recovery from your torn chest is going well as also?
Yeah, it's going very well. I'd say I'm about 90 to 95% recovered. It doesn't even bother me much in the gym anymore. For a long time, it would be tight, and it would be a lot weaker. But I did so much therapy, and I had a great therapist in Columbus to help me out with that, that at this point, it's not even an issue, and it's just getting out there in competition and doing my routines now.
Paul and Morgan Hamm, not long after this interview was recorded, were both named to the U.S. gymnastics team for the 2008 Olympic Games. Sadly, both of them were forced by injuries to withdraw before the games began. The American gymnastics team ultimately earned the bronze medal at those games, finishing behind China and Japan. You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Next is an excerpt from an interview I recorded with Margaret Grossi, director and co-producer of a marvelous documentary for the PBS series American Experience, a film called The Boys of 36. Inspired by Daniel James Brown's book, The Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. You may have seen a wonderful commercial film that tells the same story called The Boys in the Boat. Did this particular story cross your path in any particular moment or in any particular way? I mean, or for a long, long time, have you somehow known about this this team of rowers, the so-called Boys of 36?
I did not. In fact, Mark Sammels, who is the executive producer of American Experience, sort of had his eye on this story. And he had known some of the work that we've done, our team had done in the past. and he contacted me about doing it. But once I picked up the book and started reading it, Daniel James Brown's Boys in the Boat book, which this is based on, you could see right away that this was a very visual story, a very American story, and very appealing in its underdog theme. So it was kind of an automatic for me.
Ahead of us talking specifically about these young men and their story, I think it would be helpful to our listeners to make sure they understand exactly the sport that we are talking about, the event in which these young men were entered at the Olympics, and also a word about just how very popular this particular sport was back in the 1930s for some reason. So first of all, explain exactly the sport, even the exact name of this event that we are talking about.
It was referred to, it was the last race of the day in Berlin, and it was the premier race. It's referred to as the heavyweight eights, the eight or 2,000-meter race. And these boys were used to rowing longer distances in other races during the season. And in fact, there aren't that many races during a rowing season, apparently. There are maybe two or three. But the IRA, the National Championship in Poughkeepsie at that time, was a four-mile race. This is 2,000 meters, which is significantly shorter. So it would be like asking someone who is a cross-country runner to suddenly run a sprint at the Olympics for the gold medal. So no pressure there.
And we should probably describe visually what we are talking about, and I think once we do that, people will know exactly the kind of racing that we are talking about. We're, of course, talking about a long, narrow boat, which I think is called a shell.
And that's right.
And in there would be then the oarsmen seated sort of parallel to each other, and then one person at the front of the boat serving a very important function. Explain that.
Yes, they're actually kind of stacked one behind another in rowing, as most people can see it when they watch some of these races, if they ever have. But these are big guys too; they're really big. Six feet it would probably be kind of considered average, even at the time. Stunt McMillan, who was in what they call the engine room in the middle of the boat, he was at least 6'5".
Wow!
And they're in a shell that at the time was made of cedar, not very wide, 62 feet long, with eight of these big guys in it, having to row in complete, kind of synchronization, harmony. And then one coxswain in the stern of the boat, who is necessarily shorter and lighter, who's not rowing, who's steering the boat and commanding the boat. I can't. There's not another sport that I've, been a fan of or experienced physically that's like it. Hmm. It's one thing to think about, say, someone like me. I've of course been in rowboats, in canoes, in kayaks, but these big guys who could probably just as easily play football or basketball in this very sort of delicate wooden shell, trying to be in perfect sync, going down a river or a lake with the wind in their faces and the waves and competition right next to them is amazing. The amount of dedication to this is amazing. These boys also, of course, at that time had to deal with thousands of spectators in Berlin chanting in their faces while they tried to do this. It's just amazing that they pulled this off.
Absolutely. And the film says that this was a tremendously popular sport, one of America's most popular sporting events back in the 1930s. One thing that we catch an intriguing glimpse of in your film is the view not only of certain fans just in the stands, as they might be for a a horse race or a track and field event or something, but even people loaded into some sort of almost like a train car that would be yet another way to experience this race. Explain what that was.
Observation trains. That was, when I saw that, that was probably the most kind of stunning visual to me once I saw, once we were looking at through the archival footage. I don't think they exist anywhere today, but I sure wish they did. Because anybody who's been to a race knows that you sit on the shore and you get one glimpse, sort of, during the race, because you have to sort of park yourself in one spot. And it's a little frustrating if you want to cheer for somebody that you're interested in, a team that you're interested in. This train ran alongside. The train was in Poughkeepsie. I know that there were trains in Seattle. And it ran on a track alongside the race course. So people could buy a ticket and sit on these trains and go along the course with the shells, with the boats, with the competition, and the entire way. And really root for their team the entire way. It was just neat. It was just really probably Daniel James Brown wrote such a wonderful book, just a beautiful story. But I think our job, and hopefully he's kind of happy with it, was that to find visuals to go along with it. And when we found this, it's just really something to see. It's really kind of delightful in a way to see these people enjoying themselves on the train, watching these races. I wish they could bring them back today. I think it would bring more people into the sport, frankly.
Sure.
And then the other remarkable thing for us was to see these thousands of people. And again, being a sports fan and knowing the history, I'm a big baseball fan. So, of course, I see a lot of footage from the 30s of baseball. Obviously, the fields, the stands full of people cheering, horse racing, the same thing, boxing in the arena. I would not have known this about rowing. That was kind of a startling thing to see as well. Thousands of people on piers, on ferries, on yachts, cheering for these races, these rowing races.
We're speaking with Margaret Rossi, who is the director and co-producer of an American Experience documentary that airs tonight on PBS called The Boys of 36. In it, we are learning about an American team of rowers that managed to capture a gold medal at the 1936 Berlin Olympics under the unlikeliest of circumstances. I think we should talk about the strange gauntlet that was part of how the team at the University of Washington was sort of handled, and the way in which the team was constructed with these various groups of young men grouped together in various boats and so on. It's kind of a chaotic picture, and I'm not describing it very well here. I will leave that to you. But I think it's important because it's an intrinsic part of understanding the special challenge that these young men were facing.
Your struggle with trying to describe what went on there was our struggle in the edit room as well, because it's a tough, very competitive process, apparently, and at the time was overseen by a very stern coach for these boys named Al Albertson. And there are eight spots in the boat, nine really, counting the coxswain, and hundreds of boys trying out for these spots in these boats. And again, at the time, with an eye toward the Olympics, one boat that was really going to make it. So it was a very competitive process.
Margaret Grossi, director and one of the producers of the American Experience documentary film, The Boys of 36. The film can be viewed via the website pbs.org. To finish out the Friday morning show here on WGTD, here is an excerpt from an interview I recorded with Sports Illustrated writer Jeremy Fuchs, talking about his wonderful book, Total Olympics, Every Obscure, Hilarious, Dramatic, and Inspiring Tale Worth Knowing, published by Workman. The book is laid out in 6 chapters: Legends, Forgotten History, Wild and Strange, Firsts, Discontinued Sports, and finally, Forgotten Heroes.
There are a lot of wonderful things to find in the chapter called Wild and Strange. You've already talked about how much you enjoy writing this sort of thing. I want to give you a second to talk about one little moment in this section of the book, which is called An Assortment of Awful Athletes. And this is a really entertaining moment in the book in which you talk about people like Eddie the Eagle, Michael Edwards, a ski jumping competitor that a lot of people have heard of. But you go beyond him, beyond Eddie the Eagle, to talk about some other exceptionally awful athletes in the Olympics. Just say a word about why this is here beyond the entertainment value of it.
Yeah, so it's certainly entertaining, right? You know, Eddie the Eagle, there was a movie that came out about it a few years ago. He qualified in ski jumping despite the fact that he couldn't really ski jump. There is time and time again, Eric Musambani from Equatorial Guinea, a swimmer, had never swam before. He qualified and then he learned how to swim. Recently there was Elizabeth Swainy, who was an American skier, but she ended up representing Hungary, which is her grandparents' country, and competed in this with a new event. This was 2018, the skiing half pipe, despite the fact that she couldn't do any tricks. This sort of happens time and time again. There's sort of ways to sort of game the system and enter. And obviously they are not what you would consider to be Olympic caliber athletes. But, it's funny, and, you could say maybe they're making a mockery of the sport and maybe taking, a spot from somebody who is more, deserving. I don't know. For me, I took a little bit different approach and thought how hard it is to just show up at the Olympics and knowing that everyone's sort of watching and maybe making fun of you. I think it speaks to the power of the Olympic dream, of the power of dreams in general. Somebody has a dream to be a top athlete, whether it's, in the NBA or the Olympics. Sometimes stubbornness can be a good thing, and not realizing that you're not good enough to compete in a, respectable fashion, I think is actually admirable. I don't think it's a joke at all. For me, these are people who know they're not going to win, right? They know they're not going to contend. They know they're not going to be a factor, right? They're not going to get a medal. But they're going to compete. They're going to represent their country. They represent themselves and their family. They may fall. Eric Musambi from Equatorial Guinea did not do well, but he actually gained the, support of the crowd, much like Eddie Eagle did. Obviously, they made a movie out of it. So, these are non-traditional Olympians for sure. They're not there because they're contenders, but they're there because they have dedication and because they have heart. And, you don't just show up, right? You have to train. You have to put effort into it. And I think anybody who puts effort into it and, does what they can to do their best, even if their best is nowhere near other people's best, I think it's still worth celebrating.
Mm. I do want to again remind people about the section called Legends, and just about every great Olympian is there. I mean, all of the superstars, and a very inspiring section that ends the book called Forgotten Heroes, in which we look at other champions who should be better remembered than they are. Many of them who have tremendous qualities. And I appreciate all that I find there. I want to finish out with an athlete we have already mentioned briefly, the legendary Jim Thorpe. And he was, of course, stripped of the two medals that he won in the 1912 Olympics in Stockholm, and then had those medals restored to him 70 years later. And he was stripped of those medals because it was found that he had played some semi-pro baseball. It's interesting. I've always found it kind of a curious story because, in fact, he did break the rules. I mean, in a sense, the stripping of his medals was not at least completely an injustice, or at least that's what I've always thought. I mean, I thought it was sad, unfortunate, but not necessarily an injustice. you actually make a pretty persuasive case for it being actually a terrible thing to have done to Jim Thorpe, and the fact that he shares his medals with other athletes is something of a farce. Just say a quick word about this aspect of the story of the great Jim Thorpe.
Yeah, you know, Jim Thorpe is obviously, you know, probably one of the best athletes, you know, that we've to hit the scene, right? And so it makes sense that he would sort of dominate the Olympics. You know, he was this multi-sport athlete. And, you know, like you said, semi-pro baseball was his downfall. I think, you know, some context is needed, too, in the fact that, you know, had this happened in 2000, he would not have been banned. You know, we know this, that people are making money off of the sports, right? You can turn on the TV, now you're going to see an ad for Simone Biles. You're going to see an ad with Michael Phelps, right? People are making money. Jim Thorpe came, you know, he was unlucky, I guess, to be born when he was born. And so he was, you know, disqualified. He got the medals back. But, you know, Jim Thorpe is a legendary athlete, right? He was the first Native American to win gold for the U.S. And he just sort of got it stripped from him, and he's still the co-champion, even though he was so dominant. And obviously, again, hindsight helps in this case, but for me, here is maybe one of the best athletes ever, and it just felt that he was sort of given a raw deal. You know, he didn't make much money playing semi-pro baseball. You know, the ideal of amateurism was sort of held up in the Olympics for so long, and then it just sort of went away. And now it's like not even a thing, right? You see professional athletes all the time. And so, you know, I think it's great he got his medal back. Obviously, I understand the awkwardness. You don't want to take it away from somebody who had it for all these years. But I think Jim Thorpe, you know, deserves his place as perhaps one of the best athletes ever. And I think it's unfortunate that he sort of got caught up in something that now is just no longer really a thing in Olympic history.
And one of the things you mentioned in your story is that when he was stripped of his gold medals, the athletes then that were to receive gold instead, Hugo Weisslander in the decathlon, Ferdinand Bie in the pentathlon, refused to receive those gold medals. I mean, even they felt that a terrible injustice had been done. Just one of a number of fascinating stories to be found in this book called Total Olympics, Every Obscure, Hilarious, Traumatic, and Inspiring Tale Worth Knowing, published by Workman Publishing and the author Jeremy Fuchs. Jeremy Fuchs, thank you for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
And to hear my interview with writer Jeremy Fuchs in its entirety, check out the podcast version of the morning show. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. It's 8:58 here on WGTD. On Monday's morning show, you'll hear the interview that I recorded with Julia Nowicki and Ben Woods talking about a brand new work called Toward Justice that celebrates the Equal Protections Clause of the U.S. Constitution. They are going to be performing that on Tuesday evening, July 30th, at the Civil War Museum. Ben as narrator, Julia Nowicki, the librettist, also as member of the Prairie String Quartet. You can hear the story of that on Monday's morning show. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. From WGTD's Arts and Other Events calendar, the Kenosha Book Festival 2024, Chapter 4, is this Sunday. 20 guest authors and thousands of $1 used books will be at Studio Moonfall. That's 5031 7th Avenue. That's from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. this Sunday, July 28th. It's a great opportunity to support some local authors. Let's talk about our weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois. It calls for sunny skies today and a high of 79 degrees. Clear skies and mild overnight with a low of 63. Sunny tomorrow and a high of 83. On Sunday, partly sunny, a 40% chance of rain and a high of 87. Very similar forecast on Monday. It's going to stay quite warm as we extend into next week. Daytime highs close to 90 degrees. Again, best chance for rain will be on Sunday and Monday. You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, WPHT.